Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The U.S.-Israel war on Iran is far from over. It's possible it may never really end. Nonetheless, the geopolitics of West Asia has experienced a fundamental shift. American military power has limits, and this has profound implications for the entire world. Crosstalking a Strange New World, I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Eretz in Montreal. He is director of the Rising Tide Foundation of Canada. In New York, we have Michael Rossi. He is a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. And in Austin, we cross to Ryan Milton. He is a political analyst, consultant, and activist. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first in New York. I suppose one of the most frustrating things in observing this senseless war is the lack of a learning curve on part of the American-Israeli side. The use of military force is shown to be futile. Yeah, you can destroy things and you can kill people, but it's not changing political outcomes. It's not generating them. And it's frustrating watching how Iran definitely wants to see this war come to an end. And the Trump administration, with its cohort of the Israelis, refused to let it end. And so where is the learning curve here? And I suppose that's what the problem is. There's no learning curve. Michael.
There is no learning curve, and don't expect any coming from either Trump, Rubio, or Netanyahu. I don't know about you, but the belief, if there was a belief, that one could effectively get a state to capitulate in 48 hours solely and exclusively through artillery fire is futile. I mean, it's just absolutely, it's just novice in that regard. Iran is not a small country that one can push over like Venezuela. And maybe just perhaps the State Department and Pentagon were operating on the assumption that a couple of days of artillery bombardment like NATO had done to Yugoslavia in 1999 would get the government to capitulate. But that had not been the case. And I think that it was pretty clear within the first 72 hours that Iran was not going to capitulate. And neither Trump nor Netanyahu, or even more broader, neither the United States nor Israel had a backup plan for that.
Yeah, Ryan, because as we saw the kind of obviously fake negotiations before the war last year and this war that started in February of this year here, they were fraudulent negotiations. There was no intent of having an agreement with Iran. So that we're all past that. So it's very frustrating, you know, they're begging for a deal. We all know that is a patently untrue. It is a lie. And so what we get from the administration, very bizarrely, at least from, you know, an objective, pragmatic view, is that they have a strategy of hope and beliefs. That's all. Nothing more. There's nothing tangible you can grab onto. Ryan.
Yeah, look, the thing that I think about in that regard is that power projection is over. We used to go along with that idea. You just send a carrier battle group and that will scare everybody into action. The problem, I think, is that we now believe the lies of people like Paul Wolfowitz, that we can somehow play the verbal and visual game of containment, negotiate through military force. And it's become a Malaysian monkey trap. We're the ones that actually need the ceasefires. We're the ones that need to pull out. We can't extricate ourselves, but we have this arrogant triumphalism that goes back to the fall of the Soviet period, where we don't respect our enemies militarily, at least with the mutual assured destruction. We thought that we could die. And now that doesn't even cross the minds of the planners and advisors to the president.
Well, exactly, because Matthew, we've all witnessed here the use of military force is not getting the result that the administration wants. So what do they do? Oh, resort to military force. I mean, this is so counterproductive. And during the same time, it's not reported in Western media, but it's reported in media outside of the West, is that the United States is being driven out of the Gulf. I mean, now they're putting all of their assets in Jordan. They're getting hit, and they're going to all have to move to Israel eventually, and then Israel eventually will get hit. I mean, I'm not a military expert. I'm just an observer, and that's what I see. Matthew.
Yeah, it is sort of the definition of insanity, according to Einstein, right? Get it doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results. Except I think that you have, on the one hand, this obsession with theory, that they have this idea of, you know, greater Israel and Abraham Accords, this idea of making the Gaza the Riviera. And maybe on paper for certain people, that sounds like an attractive idea. But then you have, I think, what the real agenda is from the inside, which is ultimately do everything possible to break up and destroy the emergent system that China has led, that Iran has played a center point in as far as the broader Belt and Road Initiative, the different corridors, the North-South transportation corridor that passes through Iran. And I think that's really what is the secret mission ultimately is to try to do everything possible to tear the cohesion as much as possible. But it's ultimately blowing back because all of the necessary supply chains, the rare earths, everything that the United States has needed to just simply exist, let alone project power, is breaking down faster than anything else. So it's the blowback is heavy, and they're not learning their lesson.
Yeah,
let me just add to that one thing,
go
by
right
the
ahead.
Way, which sure. is that Iran with conventional weapons has boxed in the United States.
Yes.
And that's important because we keep talking nuclear.
Yes.
But Iran has used conventional weapons and they dominate the battlefield.
Michael, that's absolutely true, because what we have here is a non-nuclear power not aspiring to be a nuclear power defeated two nuclear powers using conventional power. That's an extraordinary event, Michael.
Yes. And I mean, in this case, I would venture to assume that once this conflict is over, Iran will be pursuing the acquisition of nuclear weapons. That is more than abundant at this point. The understanding
they have a fatwa against that. They're not interested in nuclear weapons at all.
I would be hard pressed to. I might be able to accept that, but there is that understanding that
they don't need it. They don't need it. They're winning.
They don't need it. But fatwas can come and go at the same time too, right?
Hang on, guys. I can add to this conversation. I agree with Michael and I agree with Ryan. You can both make a case where I can agree with a theory of the case. I agree. The problem I have with the gentleman is proliferation after that. Saudi Arabia, Turkey,
yes.
etc. That's the problem I have. And that would make Iran far less safe. Okay. However, everybody is aware of the Libyan model and the North Korean model. So I'm not going to argue against either position. I can see where both positions can go. And I would prefer less nuclear weapons in the world than more. Matthew, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to throw one. I agree. Either case could be defended, but the fatwa came in 2003, and like you, I also share the fear that this could be something. If they go for it at this point, this is a completely new world at that point, with many other powers racing for nuclear weapons. That would be terrible. But I think we're also at the end of a system that has really held down human potential for a long time. So we're entering something new, and it's really a race for who's going to determine the conditions of that new system. And we know that with the U.S. State Department coming out, or the Department of War now coming out, last December or November, with their new strategic doctrine, calling for a consolidation of their efforts at a sort of North American empire.
Yeah.
I know that some people have celebrated that, saying, oh, look, maybe this is part of an agenda. They're looking for an excuse to extricate themselves from their Middle East gambits and to create a space for a Eurasian type of power to emerge while the U.S. consolidates Cuba and North America and Greenland. But honestly, that may only partially be true as well. I think ultimately at the end of the day, this idea of Rubio speaking about multipolarity and acquiescence is an illusion. I don't think they really want that. I think at the end of the day, they want to ultimately have hegemony, maybe in the long run, though.
You're making reference to the early in the administration, Marco Rubio's interview with Megyn Kelly, I think it was. But I dismiss that. I mean, the when that doctrine came out, let me throw this to Michael, is that was working under the assumption that there would be a greater Israel that would enforce American diktats in West Asia, and the United States could pick on the poor people of the Western Hemisphere. Michael.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to see when, you know, Rubio says something a couple of months ago, whether it still holds validity today. I do remember that interview, and I do remember a lot of eyebrows being raised at him being one of the first people to acknowledge
that. Well, we liked it. We all liked it. We wanted to hear that. Yes.
But what's interesting about all of this is multipolarity does not hold itself particular to a geographic region. Mm. So there might be an understanding that certain areas would fall under Russia's sphere, others would fall under China's sphere. But America's sphere, as Rubio most likely would think about, is, yes, a very much alive, well, and empowered Monroe Doctrine. But where does it leave the Middle East? And where does it leave the Levant? The United States is not going to abandon Israel. It is going to use Israel as well as its presence in the Mediterranean as a way of extending that North American influence into as much of Europe and at least the western part of the Middle East as possible. And whether or not Iran would play by this new reality and just shift eastward into BRICS or be the last piece of the puzzle that needs to be taken down in order to ensure Israeli hegemony, this is effectively what's being played out today.
Well, I think what's being played out today.
Well, hold on a second.
Go ahead.
There's a lot of desperation involved, however. So a lot of these words that come out from U.S. policymakers, they sound very tough, but you look at the last 63 years move away from national economic development to globalization and financialization. We can't afford that. The military industrial complex business model is failing. So, you know, we can say these kinds of things. China is eating our lunch. One thing about Iran is that they've switched over to China's Baidu much better than GPS. They can pinpoint things within
millimeter. We have a hard break, gentlemen. I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a break. And after that break, we'll continue our discussion on this strange new world. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing strange new worlds. Okay, let's go back to Matthew in Montreal. In looking how Iran is behaving, reacting to the unprovoked war against it, a war of choice on the part of the United States and Israel, the Americans and the Israelis have never been able to explain why, that's par for the course. But obviously, Iran is exercising its sovereignty. It's basically a prison break after 47 years of being under sanction and isolated by the West. And Iran is emerged, and depending on who you want to ask and depending on how this unfolds, could emerge very much as a very important world power. So, Matthew, one of the things that, with the war as a backdrop, it seems to me that most of the world is embracing the idea of a multipolar world, and I think it's actually happening, except for the United States particularly cannot accept that. It cannot accept limited hegemony. And this is what we're facing on a global stage right now. Matthew.
Yeah, no, I think that the idea of globalization, unipolarity, the end of history has proven that it doesn't work, that the majority of the world population has rejected it. And even the American people, in the their best of expression voted for Trump and created this whole MAGA movement originally because they were sick of war and they wanted manufacturing and they wanted to focus on just building up their lost capabilities once again. That didn't end up happening. There's a lot of betrayal there, obviously, but the sentiment internationally is very strong towards multipolarity. But I think it's an underdefined idea, and there's a fight over notion of it. Will it be Orwellian, Eurasia, East Asia, Oceania type of structure of some evil Yalta 2.0? Or is it going to be something founded upon working with faith and trust in your neighbors and other civilizations?
Or maybe a novel idea, international law, maybe that would be thrown in there too.
You know, actually respected,
Michael, when talking about a multipolar world, and it's already been suggested here as kind of spheres of influence, I don't think that's what the global South, that's what the world wants. There'll always be stronger powers and then there'll be smaller powers, but everyone's sovereignty has to be respected, and that would be done through this very novel idea that the Americans have abandoned, and certainly the Israelis, is international law. You know, and we all see the flaws of international law. The stronger you are, the less likely you're going to adhere to it. But there's no better game in town, in my opinion. Go ahead, Michael.
So, the understanding that multipolarity is here to stay. I mean, if anybody had doubted that multipolarity was here, the current situation in Iran has absolutely nailed that, into the coffin. I mean, that is beyond a doubt now. When we were talking about spheres of influence, this is something that, I mean, I confess I am using the rhetoric that is coming from the U.S. State Department, from the Pentagon. I talked before about Russian spheres of influence, Chinese spheres. These are not competitive, right? These are cooperative. These are seen as part of not so much an anti-Western coalition, but just simply a non-Western coalition that is, you rightly pointed out, predicated more so on state sovereignty instead of corporate sovereignty. If there is one real dividing line between the West and the rest, it is that corporate sovereignty drives the West. This is why we have the Elon Musks and the Richard Bransons and the Jeff Bezoses. In the non-Western world, corporate oligarchs, corporate elites cannot be who they are without the support and the cooperation from their respective state governments.
Exactly.
This is how it works.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And I'm trying to understand oligarchs around the world. They are very different from Western oligarchs. Ryan, one of the issues that is in front of us is like the future of the petrodollar, which, it perpetuates the current system. Diminishing that or undermining it, again, enhances the sovereignty of other countries. And this is what this is all about. That's, and I don't want to go into details here. I'm just trying to figure out what Saudi Arabia is doing in all of this. Is it making more and more enemies instead of fewer and fewer? Because they're the ones on the chopping block here. If the petrodollar goes, they're going to be living in a very, very different reality. Ryan.
Right, right. And will they actually ever sign those Abraham Accords?
No.
Ansarallah has them cornered. Little teeny Ansarallah has them cornered. And from that standpoint, and what some of our others are saying here, let's also reflect on what Kennedy said at his America University speech, where he said, no government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. We can learn from these other countries. We can be completely sovereign and independent, and we can actually interact with them, compete even on a way that actually enhances our own economy. The kingdom of Saudi Arabia and these other kingdoms, they're also destined for the dustbin of history, just like that old project for the new American century that we don't hear about anymore. These kinds of unipolar ideas are out. National sovereignty is in. Also, let's go back to 2007 with President Putin and his Munich address, where he specifically attacked those doctrines, specifically said that it is international law against unilateral actions, and that the whole idea of a single superpower is flawed. So I do think that These countries, they're going to have to go and make peace with Iran. We're probably going to have to leave the region. And we're going to find out that cooperation actually brings us much more wealth, real wealth, I'm talking about, than, you know, speculative wealth or, as I said, the business model from the military-industrial complex, which only enriches just a small number of people. Because with Donald Trump, we were waiting for, you know, great infrastructure projects. We were waiting for lots of investment. And, you know, he wanted to take on the deep state. Sadly, maybe the deep state has taken him on. So USAID and the NED, they've grown, unfortunately. And I know that his support base is very upset about that.
Yeah, Matthew, what has unipolarity done for the American people since the Second World War? I mean, you know, this is one of the things, you know, America's hegemony, you know, it stands taller, it sees further, Madeleine Albright's speech, you know. But what has it done? Yeah. I don't see that it's done anything good for the American people. It's been disastrous for the rest of the world. Matthew.
Yeah, and it's been disastrous for the American people as well. It gave them, I think it created this illusion, this perversion of the city on the hill idea that was a noble idea that the U.S. should be something that could be seen as a role model to be emulated and as an inspiration for other people seeking freedom around the world. And the best of times that tradition expressed itself in that way. But a perversion of this thing has always sort of been lurking about as the those who admired the Roman Empire over the Roman Republic were always lurking about the deep state structures for really since 1776. And these institutions oversaw the murder of many presidents, and especially since World War II, have really just taken this notion of we are the police lords of the world because we're the most free, thus we should enslave the most. They took that to the extreme, and a lot of American people got a little bit drunk on that idea of easy, you know, Walmart's, Dollarama's, easy living without having to produce, without having to manufacture, especially since the 70s. And now they've resulted in living in a giant bubble of being mostly useless eaters and with useless jobs because we exported all of our useful jobs to other countries that were supposed to be doing the dirty work for us and remaining too poor to actually buy the things that we were supposed to be able to produce. But now we're seeing that the reality is striking us hard and we have to make a big course shift now. And I don't know if it's too late because most of the economy has become a giant debt-based bubble and our means of production and guiding our own destiny is really handicapped. So we have to, I think, eat some humble pie fast and learn what real multipolarity and rule of law is because we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, Michael, with the lack of munitions that Trump denies, I mean, that is a result of the economic system that was developed over many presidencies, is that you make weapons that are super, super expensive. You don't really expect them to use them because you just scare people with them. But you actually come across a competitor that says, no, you have to use them. And then you realize you don't have very many of them. And actually, a lot of them don't work very well. Michael.
And it doesn't look good. It does not look good.
Oh, it doesn't look good.
Yeah. For the narrative of American military might. It's another death knell in the idea that we are still in a unipolar world. I would say that American unipolarity didn't start at the end of the Second World War, but certainly at the end of the Cold War. Sure. It was, for the most part, I would say, a 15-year run. Let's say, roughly speaking, say 1991 until I would say multipolarity really hit in 2021. So about 20-year period when we were chased out of Afghanistan with the Taliban. And it was a slow, progressive move towards multipolarity, beginning with the 9/11 attacks. And it certainly was obvious during the 08-09 economic crisis. But as my colleagues here rightly say, unipolar powers do not go gracefully, and they don't learn from their mistakes because they do everything in their power to maintain that hegemony and that illusion that they are still on top. They might have had a setback here or there, but they can still get back on top. And what makes it even more hard for them to accept is coming to terms with countries, and the United States is notorious for doing this, coming to terms with countries that they ascribe adjectives to. We will not sit at the same table and learn from the Iranians, from the Russians, from the North Korea. You might remember in Trump's first term, he went to North Korea to speak personally Kim Jong-un, which I myself thought was a fantastic move.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
And everyone from Republican to Democrat were saying, how could you possibly go to this country and talk to such a horrible, horrible individual? Well, here he is right now hobnobbing with Netanyahu at Lindsey Graham's funeral. And no one raises an eye with that. It doesn't matter that you're a horrible leader. It matters that you're horrible based on the American narrative that they are anti-American, anti-Western. So you can absolutely hobnob with the Saudis, the Israelis, the Ukrainians, and if, you know, heaven help you if you sit there at the same table with the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians and the Indians and you map out a new multipolar world, because that means that you could.
You know what's really interesting in the last few seconds we have here is that John F. Kennedy's university speech was mentioned. It's really remarkable how often I hear that being invoked now. For decades, I didn't hear it. And now it's being invoked so much. And I think that's a sign that we have a way out. We have a way of thinking. I want to end on a good note here. Okay, well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in New York, Montreal, and in Austin. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.